We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
The Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is August 12th, and we are just counting down the days until the November 5th election. And you might have seen that Donald Trump is back on X, at least in terms of ad campaign. So when I opened the app this morning, the first thing that I saw was an ad placed from the @RealDonaldTrump account saying, are you better off now than you were when I was president? Our economy is shattered. Our border has been erased. We're a nation in decline. He posted then an ad from DonaldJTrump.com with the hashtag Trump on X. Meanwhile, Kamala Harris is on Truth Social. Donald Trump's own platform has amassed over 300,000 followers there, and the only account that her account is following is Donald Trump's. So a little bit of trolling there. But digital ads are making a really big splash for this election. So according to eMarketer, digital's share of total political ad spending will nearly double to 28.1% in 2024. This is up from 14.1% in 2020. And that is a bigger jump than the one seen between the 2016 and 2020 presidential election years. There's a lot of controversy, of course, over online ads, digital manipulation, but $16 billion is forecasted, according to Yahoo Finance, expected to be spent on political ads about 30% of that being spent online. So how is the digital marketplace affecting our election, especially for Gen Zers that will be voting in their very first election? And there is also this controversy over whether or not Kamala Harris's campaign digitally altered one of the photos that she posted online, or her campaign posted online from her rally. And so that's been made fun of extensively over the weekend, with one comedian saying that Kamala Harris had a million people at her rally. You can't make this up. And it was very clearly digitally altered. So joining me now to discuss all this and more, and how the digital will impact November, is our good friend Jake Denton, who is a tech policy advisor at the Heritage Foundation. So, Jake, let's start with this controversy with Kamala Harris and AI, because a lot of people immediately, of course, on the right are suggesting that this was an altered image. Now some people are suggesting it's not. I haven't seen a statement from the Harris campaign, but overall this does present a problem, or at least highlights a problem, that there can be a lot of AI manipulation and digital ad content that is manipulated. So how is this going to potentially affect the election?
Yeah, good morning. I think, the instinct to question the media files coming out of the official channels on both sides is very good. You should be, questioning whether or not a photo is real or fake. This is just the reality we live in now. But with that being said, the official channel doesn't appear to have actually published anything with an egregious deepfake. The thing in question is really the crowd size. And everyone has now seen these images with, people in the crowd with four arms, which is a clear sign of digital alteration, AI-generated content.
Or maybe too many COVID shots. I don't know. I mean, that could be a thing. But
exactly. Yeah, it doesn't appear to have actually come from the main channel. It's coming from, random Twitter accounts, anonymous accounts. And then it's getting mainstream notoriety. And so this is where it gets really interesting. It isn't necessarily flowing from the official channels, but it's taking over the narrative. And so I think, the instinct should stay the same, question everything, but also understand that this is going to be used to explain uncomfortable truths. It's uncomfortable that there were a lot of people that showed up. It's not a deep fake. It's just reality.
Yeah, and that is something, of course, that the right is going to have to contend with, that there are a lot of people showing up at the Harris rallies, which is a contrast, of course, between the little circles in 2020 that we saw, the maybe six people that showed up for Joe Biden. I mean, there definitely, whether it's a bubble, whether it's temporary, there is enthusiasm behind Harris. And so I was glad to see that the Trump campaign is now putting ads, but this is at least the first one that I have seen, and it may have been that he started that a little bit earlier, but at least is posting ads on X. And so with $16 billion expected to be spent on political ads this cycle, with, you know, around 28 or about 30% in digital ad spending, I mean, a lot of this is, of course, geared toward the younger voter. How influential are these types of ads?
Oh, they're huge. It really, you know, it makes or breaks a race. Prior to joining Heritage, I did this professionally. You know, I was working with candidates, placing digital ads, and it really can make or break a campaign. But I think what a lot of people don't understand is that both sides don't have access to the same tools or the same quality of advertisements. You know, oftentimes you look at these ad spends, they're just a number, you know, $16 billion on spends, and we think that, you know, this stuff just magically appears on your phone, but it's coming from either primarily a Google platform or a Meta platform. And they've made it very clear they don't like the right's message. And so they deliberately handicap the performance of these advertisements for candidates. It's a known fact. But then even, you know, you look beyond that, in the commercial side of things, there's over $160 billion, with a B, worth of advertisement fraud every year. And so what that looks like is just spoofed impressions giving you essentially false positives on your campaign. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. You spend on these things because, you know, it is the best way to reach people. But you can also just be lighting money on fire. And so with Elon actually caring about, you know, conservative values, there's a good chance the message hits the phones of the right audience. But broadly, the left has a huge advantage here when it comes to digital ads.
Yeah, that is the unfortunate reality. Well, we all remember the Zuckerbucks and, you know, all of that that was so controversial, and there were lawsuits around that in 2020. And then meanwhile, just last week, Google had the first ruling against them on an illegal monopoly on search, a U.S. judge finds. And so you mentioned that, you know, Google and Meta are two of the biggest platforms, are obviously very, very leftist. Does that ruling at all on the violation of antitrust law, I mean, that was related to search, but can that also affect, or has that affected the algorithms in terms of how ads populate to users?
Yeah, you know, it's no question that, you know, the Google monopoly over search has had a dramatic impact on, you know, the political side of things as well. But, you know, they also essentially have a duopoly over the advertising markets with Meta. And they do the same exact funny business of suppressing search results. They suppress ads. And, you know, this ruling inches closer to that. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion that they would break those things up. But we're getting closer. You know, there's a few bills in, you know, the Congress that haven't really moved that do the same thing. Senator Lee has the America Act, which would, you know, target the ad monopolies. But, you know, Congress doesn't like to do these things. They sound very dorky. They don't move on them. But we're getting closer. There's like a conscious shift in the public conversation. And it's clear people understand these platforms now and the consequences of a monopoly here.
Yeah. And well, you know, we like dorky. I think that nerds actually run the world. So, you know, Congress shouldn't just be concerned about the lights and cameras. They should actually listen to the policy wonks, in my view. And I'm speaking to one of the great policy wonks, which is Jake Denton, who is in tech policy for the Heritage Foundation. And, you know, all of that in terms of the $16 billion and all of this that's spent on political ads. I mean, that's actual ad buys through campaigns themselves, through PACs. And official generated content. But what about all of the social media influencers? I mean, the people who have masses of following, I think that probably Trump has the advantage there, at least in terms of the people that go viral, that are posting their own content, whether it's paid, whether it's compensated in any way, just in terms of, you know, access or any of those things. A lot of these people are just doing it because they really support Donald Trump. And do you think that that is just as influential in terms of an ad, and why some of this historically has been suppressed on leftist platforms?
Absolutely. You know, this is the secret ingredient for a digital campaign. You know, if you don't have these large public profiles backing you, it's really easy for major stories to just slip through the algorithm. You know, these are who really place important things. You know, you look at the Tim Walz Stolen Valor controversies, that's being pushed almost entirely through large influencer accounts. And then it gets picked up by the smaller ones, and you now suddenly have a story that's dominating the algorithm. If you don't have that, these things kind of slip away. But I will kind of caution, you know, we're overly obsessed with X. It's where all the conservatives are. But when you look at Instagram and TikTok and these other platforms, the left has a huge advantage with these influencers. And they're not traditional political commentators. They might be beauty influencers or travel bloggers that are being represented by traditional Hollywood talent agencies and putting them into the political conversation. And that really resonates with, you know, non-traditional voters, Gen Z voters. Their favorite beauty blogger is now suddenly a political advocate. And you just decide to vote that way. It's stupid, but it is the way, you know, Gen Z kind of votes. I'm part of Gen Z. This is just kind of the reality. And so we have to look beyond X. And I think that's where this kind of starts to get interesting. How do we pull in some of these non-traditional commentators to commentate on right-wing kind of talking points?
Yeah, and that's a really great point that a lot of these, I mean, I'm on Instagram and the different algorithms of specific things or topics that I follow, I mean, I can tell when an ad pops up and they're like, you know, we think you'll be interested in this. And 9 times out of 10, I definitely am interested, whether or not I end up buying the product or I just scroll past or whatever. I mean, the algorithms are actually really well tailored to a user's content. And so so for Gen Z in particular, I mean, do you think that there is an awareness that this is going on with influencers that are turning political, or is it more of kind of a passive effect on a lot of them that just their favorite influencer is now suddenly political and they're not really thinking about it, and that's prompting them to go vote? I mean, I can imagine if, you know, Taylor Swift gets involved in this campaign like she did in 2020 with Joe Biden, that would have a huge effect on Swifties who are very loyal to her. And we all may think that that's, you know, ridiculous or that's cool or whatever we think about it, but that is the reality.
Yeah, you know, Gen Z grew up with their heads in their phones. I think I got my first social media account when I was in the fifth or the fourth grade. And then you just kind of scale with that. And so you don't really notice the influence campaigns if you haven't been, you know, made aware of them. And I look at my, they oftentimes just kind of follow the herd. And so when you have a blue check account or someone with a lot of followers, you know, make a political point or something of that nature, it's the popular thing. If you see the likes and the comments in support of it, you just go along with it. And I think basically you have to live through a presidential cycle where you see the manipulation to then come out the other side and understand that it happened to you. And for Gen Z, that really hasn't happened yet. A lot of them didn't really vote in 2020. It was a COVID year. And so this was really the first time that Gen Z is going to be involved in a presidential cycle. And they're definitely up for grabs, but they're also very susceptible to the left's digital tricks.
Yeah. And so, Jake Denton, do you think that we're going to see even more, I guess, landmark jurisprudence come out of, you know, some of these types of issues because we're seeing such a rise on digital ads and some of this space that that then, you know, can and will be used probably in 2028 even more than it is in 2024. And we'll see that jump again.
Yeah, I really don't think it's going to happen in the judiciary branch. You know, I think it really is going to stem from Congress. But Congress is going to have to get serious about this. And, you know, it's very puzzling when I look at this. I was on the campaign trail for many years, and I saw the passion with these candidates of feeling like they had been disadvantaged on these digital platforms. But then they get to Washington, and they just don't care to actually legislate on the issue. And so it's going to have to, you know, really become a focal point of the next Congress and the Congresses after that of, you know, leveling the playing field. We don't have access to the same tools, and eventually that is going to basically make it impossible to win. So Congress is going to have to do this. You know, we've seen with all of these social media cases, whether it be in the Supreme Court or lower courts, they just don't really understand what they're working with here. Congress needs to give them some direction.
Yeah, and maybe again, listen to the policy wonks. But last question, Jake Denton, and always appreciate your time. What do you make of Kamala Harris being on Truth Social? I thought that was a good move for her campaign. I mean, Trump is on X, so, you know, it's interesting. 300,000 followers.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I don't know how many of those followers are actually real. You know, no platform is immune to the bot problem. A lot of those are probably spoofed followers. You know, if you make a Truth Social account, you don't post anything. You'll have 100 followers in a week. Just kind of the way the platform works. So I don't really think much of it. It's kind of just a funny taunt at the Trump campaign, but I don't think it'll really move anybody.
Yeah. That's good to hear anyway. But Jake Denton, you can follow him at RealJDenton on X, which, of course, if you are part of the political conversation, then generally X is where you want to go, but then also on Truth Social as well. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. A recent study reports that the rapidly declining global birth rate will lead to a major population crisis if birth rates continue to decline. Their massive support for Planned Parenthood is all part of their plan. While we may feel hopeless in the constant attack on life, there is an amazing way to fight back. When they shout abortion, we shout life. Preborn is leading the way. Every day, their network rescues 200 babies. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, a baby's chance at life doubles. The ultrasound is the secret weapon that joins a mother's heart to her child. Preborn provides ultrasounds for clinics in the highest abortion areas. Can we join hands nationwide for life? One ultrasound is just $28, but any gift will help. $5,000 will underwrite ultrasounds for an entire network for a day. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as I've been saying for a while now, we need to focus on worldview in this election because more than anything, there is, I think, not just an existential crisis in America of who are we and who do we want to become. And if you ask that question to the right versus the left, you're going to get a very drastically different answer. But there are all of these different stories that are popping up that just further lend evidence to this view that America is slowly or even rapidly, I think, being intentionally transformed by the left into a society that we don't even recognize. And so this coming from an ex-user, St. Anne's Church in Buffalo, New York, which is just a beautiful building and one of the just iconic old Catholic cathedrals, is now permanently closed. It was sold to the Islamic community for $250,000, who are converting the historic church into a mosque. So our good friend Steve Dace posted this in response. Exactly what happened in Europe is now happening here. Churches sold to become mosques. The West is in existential peril, which means our way of life is as well. It is quite possible our real problem isn't the spirit of the age as much as God himself. Is if he is out of patience with us, and nobody could blame him if he is, that is a way bigger problem than anything Democrats could even hope to come up with. So joining me now is our friend Steve Dace from The Steve Dace Show on Blaze TV. And Steve, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, whether or not we are at the end of all things depends on whether or not we have come to the fullness of time that the Bible describes at the beginning of Revelation and in some of the prophecies, or whether we have just come to the fullness of time on the conclusion of America's experiment. That's all possible. It just really depends on God's sovereignty and whether or not he is running out of patience with us. And my question is, why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he be running out of patience with us with all of the evil that is just running rampant in our society today?
Well, you know, at this point, Jenna, I think the lowest stakes we are playing for is the end of Western civilization. I think that's the bare minimum game at the poker table here, with the hands being dealt out. That's the bare minimum. And I think it's really important for people to understand, when you see all these crazy clips of these ELCA churches, like the ones, the likes of Tim Walz goes to, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, whenever you see this, where, you know, there's rainbow flags on the altar, you see women priests in Episcopalian churches say, I felt the Spirit of God with me as I was murdering my child. And if you're wondering, when Jesus talks about blaspheming the Holy Spirit being the only unforgivable sin, what does he mean? He means that. That's what he means. When you see this stuff and you see the churches being sold to mosques, you know, I think it's very important for people to understand this, okay? And my buddy comedian Brad Stein likes to say Catholics see Mary everywhere and Protestants see Satan everywhere, okay? And I'm saying this as the guy that, you know, executive produced one of the definitive movies that Christians have ever made on satanic and demonic influence. But if you didn't show up for work 3 days in a row, the devil's not doing anything to you. You're a moron, and you deserve to get fired from your job, okay? The enemy cannot shutter churches. The enemy has no dominion over the church. All right? The church is transcended through time and space. It's the only transcendent institution God ever gave us. And the enemy has no dominion here. So if there's a reason why Paul writes things in the New Testament, like throw that person out of the church into the enemy's dominion where he can have his way with them, okay? Like he writes to the church in Corinth in the hopes that being persecuted for his immorality, like the prodigal son, that person will now return to the church and seek sanctuary from it, forgiveness, redemption. So if you're seeing churches turned inside out, like you saw in Europe, and now we sit in Europe, less than 2% for the Olympics are in France right now. Less than 2% of France is evangelical. And many of the old Catholic, churches and cathedrals of old are now mosques, like what you see here in Buffalo. That is the work of Christ, I believe. I think that is the fulfillment of the other part of Revelation we almost never preach about, which is the letters to the churches. And this is where Christ warns, go back and do your former things, or otherwise I will come to you and I will take away your lampstand. So when you see the church turned inside out, I believe that's providential accountability. I think that's not the enemy. I think that we are at that point, that is where a lampstand has been removed from denominations like the ELCA, the United Methodists. When you see the churches turned into mosques, I think there is suffering God allows, permits, even brings into our lives in order to get our attention. The Lord chastens those whom he loves, like any good father does. And so I think it is very possible, if we're seeing these kinds of things in our culture, that it's not the Democrats and it's not the demons. It could be, on many of these other things that are going on in the broader culture. But if we are seeing the church turned inside out and pruned, I think that's coming from we've got a problem far bigger than Democrats and demons, and that is we are on the wrong side of the only undefeated and the most powerful being of the universe.
And I think pruned is the operative term there, because we've seen this throughout world history many times, where the church does get pruned and the church, God will always leave the remnant of the faithful Christians, because Satan can't destroy the church. He can't destroy anything that God has ordained. But when the church ceases to be the church and they are not even lukewarm, but they are literally just a perversion of what the church should be, then that is sacrilegious. It is blasphemous, and God does not honor that. And I think, Steve, what you're driving at is so correct and so well said to point this out, that the church largely, by the church, I mean people who call themselves Christians across America, not everyone who calls themselves a Christian actually is a follower of Jesus Christ. And when you call yourself a Christian and you are not following Jesus Christ, then that is living in blasphemy. That's using the name of the Lord in vain. And so what I've seen over the last, not even just this election cycle, but even, since the moral majority and how we have come so beyond even a post-truth society, is that the church, by and large, with a few really good exceptions, the overall church in America is not only weak, but has completely sold out to the secular left, to To queer theory, you know, you mentioned all of the LGBT stuff at, you know, the altar saying, using feminine mm-hmm. pronouns for God. I mean, all of this. So where are we at in terms of where the church is compared to, because everybody's just so focused on this election, but I think the church is actually a bigger problem.
I think that we are in a worldview nuclear winter. I think we're in an epistemological nuclear winter in America. And the church is largely to blame for it collectively as a centralized institution. It gave up on discipleship in the last generation. It got purpose-driven instead while completely losing its purpose and has never sold and has never successfully peddled wares. More wares than it is right now, drawing bigger crowds than it is right now, and had less influence in this culture and in this country that it inspired than it does right now. It's just not taken seriously, really, in any of the contemplative conversations we are having as a people at all. It has the least amount of political influence and leverage that that we've ever had since really the pre-Roe era, where evangelicals really weren't even a galvanizing political force until Roe v. Wade. And actually, the first time they got mobilized politically was by Jimmy Carter in 1976 as a born-again Baptist, and they voted for him. Okay, so, this is what we're seeing here is the kind of stuff that everybody knew would happen if we stayed on the road that we were on all those years. But then you always think it won't happen to you. One morning in the northern 10 kingdoms of Israel, you know, a bunch of Jewish families got up and they tended their crops like any other morning. They married off their daughters and sons like any other morning, except it wasn't any other morning. The Assyrians were outside the city gate. It was the terminal morning. The time had come. God had heard enough. He had forgiven enough. And it was tired of having his forgiveness trampled upon. And the Assyrians were now here to put the bits in their noses and take them back to Ur. And that would be the end of the 10 kingdoms. They'd be wiped off the face of the earth. And about 200 years later, same exact thing happened to the southern two tribes, what remained of Judaism. They also just thought, well, yeah, we know it's bad that we're still doing these things. And God has sent us prophets like Jeremiah to warn us of these things. Well, you know, maybe we'll be held accountable at some point, and, you know, but probably not. And we'll just, you know, marry off our sons and daughters and work our fields and argue at the city gate like every other morning, except it wasn't like any other morning. It was the morning Nebuchadnezzar showed up outside the city gate, and soon they'd be drinking their own urine and eating their own feces for food, but with one of the worst sieges that ever took place in the Bible. And the Ark of the Covenant would be lost. The temple would be lost. Society would be laid desolate. Every generation who gets judged always thinks this way, always ignores the warnings, always, okay? And always gets prideful the more obvious the signs of judgment are there. And we have all of those, what scares me more than anything is we have all of those exact same symptoms in our society right now. All self-righteous, harder. I'll do it my way harder. I'll show the love of God by removing the truth of God whatsoever, so it's really just me as a people pleaser, even harder. I won't repent, even harder. All of the signs are there, all of them.
And that's really scary and concerning for the future of our country. And unlike some of those examples from history that you gave, whether it's the Assyrians or the Babylonians or, you know, the pagan cultures at the gates of the city, our enemy is within. And
this is the first time, really, Jenna, in the history of Christendom that the church has just quit. This wasn't The Muslims didn't bring hordes with curved swords into Cappadocia and start cutting people's heads off, okay, or Asia Minor. This isn't Genghis Khan. This isn't Attila the Hun. There's no Hitler here that has co-opted the church and turned it into a figment of the state so that the salt has lost its savor. There's none of that. The church in the West just literally quit, just dipped, just said, peace out. Just completely quit.
And that paved the way. Steve Dace is my special guest today from Blaze TV. That paved the way for the rise of the Enemy Within. And as our founders suggested, and as Abraham Lincoln suggested, and many others in America's past, if America were ever to fall, it wouldn't be from the enemy without. It would be from basically our domestic enemies. And that's how I personally view the left, how I view Kamala Harris's entire worldview as a campaign. I mean, forget calling her a Democrat. She is a Satanist communist, basically a cultist that is trying on purpose to usher in a different age and transform America into something that it has never been, and to capture America from within and transform it. And that is why worldview matters so much to this election, because I see this as we are on the precipice of, as you mentioned at the very top, Steve, either Western civilization and truth persisting in this country, or Christians being the persecuted, very small minority in a way that we have never experienced in our lifetimes ever.
Amen. This will be the biggest worldview difference election I've ever voted in. And it's not really the worldview difference between Trump and them, between me and them, between us and them. And I can't make it any simpler than what I'm about to say next. Would you rather live in New York City, 1996, or London, Minneapolis, San Francisco, 2024? Because that is the whole election right there. New York, 1996 was not a bastion of conservatism. It was a melting pot of various beliefs, pro-America. A white Republican like Rudy Giuliani could beat a black Democrat, David Dinkins, for mayor, and it didn't cause race riots or race wars. Bruce Wilkerson could sit there on the church right next to Times Square and openly preach the gospel. You had Al Sharpton on the other side of town preaching whatever the hell it is, the literal hell that he preaches. All right, it was a melting pot of places, but it was patriotic. Our worldview was at least welcome. It wasn't shunned. All right. And that's really what Trump represents politically, is New York, 1996. What these people represent is London, Minneapolis, San Francisco, 2024, where our worldview is now targeted by the state for extinction. And so when I say this is the biggest worldview difference election that I've ever voted in, that's what I mean. Do we live in a country where our worldview is actually still welcomed at the table? Even if it's no longer dominant, it at least has a seat at the table. It's part of the conversation. It's taken seriously somewhat still in the culture. Or are we targeted for extinction? And those are two radically different approaches to our way of life, radically different. Beyond the fact, she's just not serious as a person. We had a dementia patient president for the last 4 years, and we've been on the brink of worrying about a nuclear exchange in Ukraine for the last 2 years, and then we had the worst attack in Israel in 50 years. All right, what happens if we follow up someone who has dementia with someone, frankly, who's retarded? I don't know how else to put it, isn't a real person, and everybody knows is not real. What will our enemies do then? I mean, maybe that's the morning that we wake up, like I just described with the Assyrians and Babylonians, and Beijing decides time to take Taiwan. Maybe that's the morning Pyongyang, the little demon over there with the bull haircut, wakes up and says, time to go ahead and see what's going on in Seoul this morning. Because that retard over there is not going to do anything about it. So let's go. And all the stuff that you don't like right now, and all the talking points and the frustrations with him and his campaign, which all of them that I share, by the way, because of what I'm talking about, I share them because of this. All right. All the stuff that you're complaining about right now, I wish we did this better, I wish you did that better. One of those two events occurs, it's going to make all that stuff look like freaking tiddlywinks. And that's the kind of stuff that's at stake here. And I think that's the kind of stuff, frankly, I think the campaign is not fully tapped into. And I think that's the kind of things that still a lot of people really don't understand on both sides of this, with their focus constantly on whether they love this guy or hate this guy. You know, elections are supposed to be about the people, not about the candidates. And you can have all the complaints and everything else you want right now, but you need to ask yourself this question. Who's more likely to not make it so Pyongyang doesn't launch at Seoul and Beijing doesn't launch at Taipei, all right? The guy who signed the Abrahamic Accords for all of his clumsiness, or this demonic retard? And the question's pretty, that's a pretty simple question right there when you boil it down. I wish the Trump campaign did a better job of boiling it down like that. All right, it's August. Maybe they'll figure this thing out here soon. All right, or maybe he'll just stop talking and we'll just let J.D. Vance do all of it because he's a rock star. But yeah, that's
well,
really what we're talking about.
And you need to continue to say this. I'll continue to say it. And you and I have been harsh critics of the campaign not saying this because we care and because we want to continue an American society that is moral and upright. And I would love to see the campaign tap into that. But this is why Worldview Matters, and we will continue to talk about that. So Steve Dace, always appreciate your willingness to speak truth so boldly. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are talking about the worldview difference that is at stake in this election and has been at stake for a while in America. I mean, this is not just a moment where we have gone from a thriving, culturally impactful church overall in America to suddenly you have a candidate like a Kamala Harris that can have broad sweeping appeal. I mean, we are no longer in a pluralistic society like Steve Dace in the last segment mentioned, you know, 1996 New York, where this was, and even growing up, I mean, this was what I understood where America was at kind of in the early to late 90s and then sort of moving forward was that, well, you know, there are a lot of different ideas that are trying to coexist together. And we are in a post-truth society, unfortunately, and we're, you know, relativistic. And so that was the battleground to then bring truth and the biblical worldview lens in a society that didn't agree on the definition of truth and was had this kind of standpoint of epistemological relativism. That's kind of where we were at. We are no longer there. We are completely in a society that is not just post-truth, is not just anti-Christian, but is fully embracing literal demonic activity. I mean, during the break, Adam and I were just talking about the closing ceremonies in Paris last night from the Olympics. And the only characterization that we can possibly put on the opening and closing ceremonies is demonic. And that's just fully on stage to come into everybody's living room, and we're just supposed to be okay with drag queen story time and a total mockery of the Christian faith and openly suggesting that we can pervert the truth so much and nobody should complain about it. And so the question then is, where is the real church? Because I think for most of us who are part of the American Family Association family and the American Family Radio family, and one of the reasons that I just love being at this ministry at this moment in time is because I think beyond, you know, the haters that tune in, and you're all very welcome, because I hope that at least this is the one place that you hear the truth. But for the vast majority of listeners, and I so appreciate hearing from so many of you daily with encouragement, prayers, suggestions, all of that, we are wanting to live rightly. We are part of churches locally that are at least still teaching the truth and trying to win hearts and minds for Christ and have not given up on advancing the church's mission and being the church in our society and truly discipling our children, understanding that the traditional institution of of marriage that was designed by God that cannot change must thrive, and having a biblical worldview perspective of everything that we do as the Christian life. And that means that we engage as good citizens in our community and in our culture. And so my pastor yesterday was just preaching on this that was just so timely. And I wanted to share a little bit of this because it was so encouraging to me, because the sermon title was How to Thrive in Chaotic Times. And it actually on the front of the bulletin was How to Survive in Chaotic Times, and survive is crossed out and replaced with thrive. And that's the challenge here, because I know for so many of us, you know, we're looking at this election and genuinely fearful, genuinely, of a Kamala Harris administration. And fear is based on the unknown. There's anxiety around what can happen and what statistically probable will happen. In terms of leftist judges being appointed, in terms of an open border policy and the Great Replacement. I mean, so many other things. Even if conservatives, and by that we generally mean Republicans, or at least the opposition to the all of the demonic crazy of the left, even if conservatives or at least people who are willing to push back against the left keep control of the House, we maybe have, 50-50 in the Senate, that will stop a lot of the bad legislation. But there is a lot that the executive can do that is just overrunning anything that the Constitution ever originally gave the executive on the federal government power for. And we know that we have a behemoth of a terrible swamp creature that is the federal government bureaucracy. And a lot of us are rightly very concerned about that. That's why we need to vote for truth, not just in the presidential race and all the way down ticket, but all the way down ticket, right? Not just the presidential race, but all the way down ticket. And we have to vote for the best people, not the perfect people. I don't think that my vote is an endorsement of a personality or even of the candidate. Sometimes your vote is saying, okay, this is better than the contrast. I wish that, we could say with confidence, we are so excited to vote for literally the best conservative candidate ever. I don't personally think that is this current election, but this is where we're at, right? And we have, as Steve Dace said, a choice between actual demonic activity that is being ushered in through the left versus not through the right. And that's really all that it boils down to. And as a good steward of our vote, I think we need to take that very seriously. And so where does that leave the church, though? Because if we are putting all of our hope in politics, then we are totally missing what the church must be in society, because politics is downstream from culture, as Andrew Breitbart famously said, but culture should be downstream from the church's influence. And that's really the key missed part here. And so how do you thrive in chaotic times? Instead of being fearful and so anxiety ridden and just, waiting until November 5th and saying, okay, what happens if there is a Kamala Harris administration? The church historically has always thrived, that remnant, not the full church that, maybe has gone off the rails, is perverting Christianity, not the wider swath of big tent, whatever, but the actual true Christians have always thrived and sometimes have thrived even greater in the midst of horrible persecution that none of us want. We never want to be persecuted. We never want to be like the early church Christians or, Christians throughout the centuries that we've seen. But the church has always thrived. Why? And here were the couple of points by my pastor that I want to share with you because I thought they were so encouraging. And this was from, the background is in Acts 17, if you want to go and read about Paul going to the church at Thessalonica. And then, of course, he wrote 1 Thessalonians and then 2 Thessalonians, which are the epistles to the church of Thessalonica. And unlike some of the churches that Paul had to admonish and say, you need to be doing things a better way and let me help exhort you and encourage you, the church at Thessalonica, he praised. So why was that church so praiseworthy? So he says in 1 Thessalonians, starting in chapter 1, verse 3, "We recall in the presence of our God and Father your work produced by faith, your labor motivated by love, and your endurance inspired by hope in our Lord Jesus Christ." So those are the three cardinal virtues of the Christian faith, of the Christian. So you have faith and love that ultimately produces hope. And hope is the total antithesis of fear and anxiety. Faith isn't just intellectually believing something. Faith is believing and acting on that belief. If we truly believe, as Christians, which we do, that God is on the throne, God's sovereignty reigns, we have an eternal hope in the Lord, and that our purpose and our mission here is to come into a right relationship with Him and encourage as many people as we can to a right relationship with God. And that is ultimately our mission here, and to steward our families and our communities accordingly, then we will act on that. And faith in believing the promises of God, we will live according to our belief in the promises of God. That will then cause our labor to be motivated by love, because the biggest display of the Christian life, of truly walking with the Lord, is speaking the truth in love. And having our labor and all of the work in the constant ministry that we have, which is our first and foremost vocation. Yes, we have jobs that we need to earn an income, but we have a primary ministry to our families. We have a primary ministry to the lost. That will be motivated by love, and we will have endurance. And what is endurance? I mean, when Paul talks about running the race with endurance in Ephesians, he's saying, I mean, it is hard. I mean, you look at the Olympians, not the, you know, woke ones and all of that stuff, but if you look at the marathoners, it is hard. It is grueling. But you have endurance to get to the finish line, because you're not motivated by fear. You're not running away from something. You are running towards something. What are we running towards? The hope that we have in the promises of God. And we need to always have joy. And hope is the patient expectation that God will fulfill his promises. And so hope is derived from and expands and outflows from the faith and the belief that we have. And so the church in Thessalonica worked with the right motives. They were inspired by the right models. And so it goes down in verse 6, and you yourselves became imitators of us and of the Lord when, in spite of severe persecution, you welcomed the message with joy from the Holy Spirit. So in spite of severe persecution, you have joy, because our model, our ultimate model, is the Lord. That is our only audience. That is only, I mean, and I can speak from personal experience with so many people who have lied about me, who have impugned my motives, who have, you know, called me all sorts of names. I mean, that nobody who does that is actually correct, right? They infer my motives based on, you know, their own beliefs or their own, you know, whatever. And at the end of the day, as much as that may frustrate me, or I may want to correct the record, you know, all of those things, at the end of the day, none of that matters, because my role model is the Lord. And if I am right with the Lord, and I know that my motives are right, like the church in Thessalonica, my model is the Lord, and also in here on earth, I have the right role models, like pastors and family in my life, and I want to become imitators of them because of their walk with the Lord and ultimately the Lord, then we'll have joy and we'll have hope. And we will then live for the right results. We will turn to the Lord and we will turn to Christ and we will have hope. So as much as we need to participate in this election, we need to pray for the salvation of America from everything that the left wants to transform, we can still thrive even if the worst happens. So do not let your hearts be troubled. God is on the throne. He is sovereign. And even if the worst happens, November 5th, we wake up and Kamala Harris is the next president, the church shouldn't be affected at all. If anything, it should prompt us to even more action because of the hope that lies within us. You can always reach me and my team, jenna@afr.net. And I hope this was encouraging to you. Have a great week. I'll see you tomorrow morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.